You're listening to an audio documentary series brought to you by the independent think tank Respublica, narrated by Jack Haldane. This is Dust to Dust. In this fourth and final episode, we outline the flaws of the UK's approach to the management of asbestos in our built environment and the failures of accountability. We explore workable alternatives to the Health and Safety Executive's current regulatory regime, drawing on best practice solutions from both the UK and abroad. Here's what we know. The UK has a large amount of asbestos-related materials lurking in all types of buildings built before 1999 when the UK ban on asbestos came into effect. We know that this material is carcinogenic and in a state of deteriorating condition, and that exposure to small amounts of these materials can cause forms of incurable lung disease. We also know that we have a system in place that can barely tell us where the asbestos is located, what type of asbestos is present, what state it is in, and to what extent it might be harming people. We know that asbestos is the nation's number one occupational killer and that the UK has the highest death rates from asbestos-related diseases in the world. This includes rising death rates among people in occupations not traditionally linked to working with asbestos, like teachers and nurses. In addition, we know that many of our homes are likely to contain asbestos and that landlords have no duty to manage asbestos in properties which they let out to rent. These are all issues which the HSE and government do not want to talk about. Most asbestos is still in place because government policy is to manage rather than remove it. The HSE believe that the control of asbestos regulations are adequate to minimise risk and that asbestos is safe if managed properly and left undisturbed. But is this sufficient? We have an estimated 6 million tonnes of asbestos across 1.5 million properties in the UK. There is evidence to suggest that health and safety practices in the UK are lagging other developed countries. There is an urgent need to reform the current regime and improve how UK authorities locate and more effectively monitor asbestos to identify buildings that pose the highest risk to public health. This final episode comes at an extraordinary time for public health awareness worldwide. The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed the UK government's inability to act in a timely manner to a widespread threat and to take lessons from other countries that have managed to avoid exorbitant human costs. Whether or not the current or any future UK government will apply the lessons of the pandemic to other, more low-lying and long-term public health crises, such as that we've raised in this series, remains to be seen. The purpose of the Airtight on Asbestos campaign is to raise awareness of the current failings of our health and safety regime, challenge some of the assumptions about the overall levels of risk and safety, and bring current policy and practice in line with the evidence and the best international standards. Our primary aim is to get upstream of the problem and put in place a preventative strategy that can limit unnecessary exposure to asbestos and stop so many people dying from asbestos-related disease in the future. Charles Pickles is the co-founder of Lucien Services, a UK-based asbestos consultancy firm. He has recently retired and has since funded the Airtight on Asbestos campaign to help bring about change. It was while spending time in hospital that Charles resolved to show how the UK was failing to adequately assure the safety of public buildings that were leading to case after case of incurable cancer.
I myself was ill and I was making frequent visits to the haematology wards and spending time rubbing shoulders with cancer patients. And this kind of shook me up. What was I doing at the time? I was the co-owner and director of the UK's, by then it was by far and away the largest asbestos consultancy in the country. So I was running, in effect, consultancy of the UK's biggest occupational killer. And I had no faith in the testing and management regime for asbestos. So after I'd been totally shook up by my experiences in the hospital, I decided from about 2016 onwards to begin to write about and to speak up about the reasons why I didn't think we had adequate control about asbestos, and how I thought, from a practical perspective, how we could improve things.
Charles recounts how one exchange with an HSE official at a conference drew his attention to the unique dangers faced by people in non-traditional occupations, particularly female teachers.
I was standing next to a stand of booklets. Well, a pamphlet was called Why Does the UK Need Tighter Asbestos Control? And a senior HSE inspector came along and I asked him about the rising death trend from people who've not worked on asbestos building sites or in dockers, but people who've just worked in buildings containing asbestos. And he firstly said that it was not yet statistically significant, and the deaths were perhaps explained by casual work before these people became teachers in this case. And frankly, the conference bell rang, and I thought then for a second, and I looked at the other colleagues I was with, and I thought about how many professional young women worked on building sites in the 1970s, you know. This is not a plausible explanation for how they became exposed to asbestos. The much more plausible explanation, which hasn't been acknowledged really, is that they were exposed at work in buildings riddled with asbestos. That's the obvious explanation, albeit an uncomfortable explanation. This matters because those buildings are still in use today.
A key challenge for all campaigners relates to statistics on how death rates are calculated and represented. According to official figures, asbestos-related deaths have been rising steeply over the past 50 years. Currently, there are more than 5,500 deaths a year attributable to asbestos. This includes about 2,600 deaths a year from mesothelioma, an incurable cancer. Because there is a latent period between asbestos exposure and the development of mesothelioma, more deaths occur in later life, with more than half of all deaths among those aged 75 and over. However, the official statistics do not include deaths for those aged over 74. Robin Howie is a physicist and occupational hygienist who has been advocating change in our health and safety regime for many decades.
All of the data from both ONS and HSE for occupational data only run up to age 74. For males, only a half of the mesotheliomas are actually seen up to age 74. The other half is age 75 upwards. The way that ONS does the calculations on deaths for any occupational group is they don't analyse the data for age 75 and upwards.
In addition, the official figures cannot accurately identify all previous occupations and therefore the potential source of exposure. Death certificates only record the last known occupation before death. This is a general problem, but especially difficult in the case of women, including teachers and nurses. Many women leave their profession to have children and raise families. Some will not return to work or will take up another occupation.
I strongly suspect that female teachers will have a shorter teaching career than males. Certainly until 1990, the death certificate was on the last occupation, and if they hadn't had an occupation, they were assigned to their husband's occupation. So I think the female mesothelioma numbers will be very substantially higher than we're actually seeing in the statistics. And no one is looking to find out the answer to that conundrum.
According to the HSE, overall death rates are now stabilising and are predicted to fall as fewer people work directly with asbestos. However, as we've said before on this series, this projection masks an accelerating rise amongst people in occupations that are not traditionally associated with exposure to asbestos materials. It also ignores the increased proportion of people who are surviving into their 80s and 90s, the ages which now account for about half of all mesothelioma deaths. Teachers and nurses working day in, day out in our schools and hospitals are dying at a rate which is significantly higher than the general population. According to one study by Howie in 2017, teachers are 5 times more likely to die from mesothelioma and nurses 3 times more likely. This points very strongly to the probability of exposure in the locations in which they work. Yet the HSE do not agree with these findings because they use what is known as proportional mortality rates, a method of analysis that calculates all deaths according to a relative level of risk. Robin Howie explains.
The PMR are not a relevant index to assess absolute risk in any occupational group. And the reason for that is that the PMR looks at comparing the mesothelioma rate for each occupation against the national average PMR. So the PMRs are not an absolute indication of risk. They're an indication of relative risk compared to the average for all industries.
Mesothelioma deaths in occupations such as construction workers or former shipyard or railway workers account for about half of all male mesothelioma deaths. This affects the number of expected deaths in the calculation of PMR. The calculated PMR for all other occupations are about half the value that would be expected.
HSE is choosing to use a standard technique. I strongly suspect that they don't understand that the technique is not applicable in this case. Either they don't understand that it is non-applicable, or they use it because it gives an answer which is beneficial to their previous lack of action in controlling asbestos.
The HSE assume that the harm caused by asbestos is largely a historical issue relating to traditionally hazardous occupations and industries. However, this view underestimates the dangers of chronic low-level exposure resulting from working in buildings containing asbestos. Mesothelioma can develop from exposure from only a small concentration of asbestos fibres, making secondary exposure no less a cause for concern. Further, it is not just those working in the buildings that are exposed. In the case of schools, children could be exposed from a considerably earlier age, with a higher probability than adults of living long enough to develop mesothelioma. As we mentioned in the last episode, a study in the USA has estimated that for every teacher's death, 9 pupils will subsequently die from exposure at school. If we take teacher asbestos exposures as an index of the children's exposures to asbestos and recognise that over their teaching career, each teacher will have taught about 500 to 1,000 children, a large proportion of mesothelioma deaths in the general population could have been contributed to or caused by exposures to asbestos in schools. Professor Julian Pato, a leading epidemiologist who we've heard several times on this series, has estimated that between 200 and 300 former pupils will die each year simply because they were exposed to asbestos in their schools during the 1960s and 1970s. All of this indicates that we are underrepresenting the harm caused by asbestos exposure and the potential source of exposure. The gaps in existing data and how we calculate death rates indicate that we do not know the real scale of the problem. However, careful examination of the available data should resolve much of the problem.
The things that are, as I think, we're going to be looking at probably another 50 or 60,000 mesotheliomas over the next 30 years. So we're looking at a hell of a lot of deaths. We're already looking at 60,000 deaths from mesothelioma in the UK to date. And I think we're looking at least the same again over the next 30 years.
In the last episode, we highlighted the fact that the HSE does not keep a centralised record of asbestos in buildings. Many other countries, including Poland and the Netherlands, have introduced a national asbestos database. The basis of our support for this has been clear from the start. A central register, available online, would enable duty holders to update any changes to asbestos plans in real time. And it would allow anyone who needs to know, including maintenance workers, the whereabouts of asbestos and the level of risk. It would also enable the HSE to audit asbestos plans and monitor risk more effectively. Of course, the sooner the UK has a centralised, detailed record of where asbestos can be found within its public estate, the sooner a programme of phased removal of the material can begin, starting with the buildings that pose the most risk. In February of 2020, we were invited to discuss the campaign on LBC Radio. There, we heard a statement from the HSE on the subject of a national asbestos database.
Sheila Fogarty on LBC. Ben is still here. Ben Kentish, LBC's Westminster correspondent. You have had a statement from the Health and Safety Executive.
I have. I put some of the suggestions that the campaigners have been talking about to them, and they suggested in reply that the current regulations are sufficient. They say there is clear guidance available for owners of buildings that contain asbestos, and that there is no clear evidence on what additional benefits a national database would bring. They say, given the sheer number of buildings that contain asbestos, it would be very difficult to maintain such a database, Sheila.
But the HSE were clearly unaware of the social enterprise, UK National Asbestos Register, established to help duty holders manage asbestos simply and safely, while better informing and educating those who may be at risk. UK National Asbestos Register, UKNA, has developed an app for smartphones called Asbestos Smart. This provides users with information on the location and condition of asbestos in buildings. The app scans QR codes displayed in public buildings, which then uploads the building's asbestos register. Asbestos Smart is a simple innovation that gives contractors and key personnel easy access to the information they need. Any school or hospital may be given its own unique QR code to signpost on its campus, allowing staff and visitors to scan and download the building's asbestos register in seconds. Contrary to HSE's statement then, a credible solution is achievable and clearly within reach. The claim that a national system would be hard to achieve and very difficult to maintain is simply false. We caught up with Andy Payton, co-founder of UKNA, to ask him about the HSE's statement.
First of all, I think the benefits over existing practice we have already demonstrated. The problem is existing practice at one level is astonishingly poor, which means thousands of people, possibly tens of thousands, we don't really know, are being accidentally exposed to asbestos every day. So existing practice isn't that good. That's the first thing. All of those things about the amount of maintenance refurbishment work, the degree of detail, hard to achieve, difficult to maintain. We've now spoken with enough people within the industry to know that those are all problems cost-effectively solvable, that they can all be solved in today's environment, and maybe they couldn't have been 3 to 5 years ago. I'd like them to go back and reinvestigate that. We can show them that they are all solvable.
Andy also touched upon what he believes to be the central challenge, a culture of institutional and behavioural resistance that makes reform so difficult to achieve.
One of the most important things that I would say in relation to the HSE statement is that there is a fundamental cultural change that is required. And this is especially so post-Grenfell Tower and even more so post-COVID. And the difference is that when it comes to matters of public health, people want to know and they expect to know, and they increasingly feel they have a right to know if they and their health may be being put at risk. Traditionally, those with authority and power, duty holders of various levels, have said, don't you worry, leave it to us. We all have it under control. And unfortunately, that has been proven too often not to be the case.
This cultural and institutional resistance to change is a problem which seemingly cuts across the HSE as an arm's-length advisor to government. The reluctance of the HSE to engage with new evidence about the dangers of asbestos explains the government's current position, but also the attitudes and behaviours of other organisations that take their advice from HSE and government. We approached the National Governors Association with a request to circulate a short questionnaire among their members. Our aim was to gather evidence about the level of asbestos awareness among school governors. The response we received was disappointing, but unsurprising. The chair of the trustees stated, NGA has been part of this conversation with the Department for Education for some time and also contributes to the guidance which you wish to challenge. For this reason, we believe it would be inappropriate as an organisation to take part in your campaign. The NGA's primary purpose should be to serve all school governors and the well-being of teachers and pupils, not the perceived interests of the DfE or HSE. There should surely be scope for an independent, objective appraisal of government guidance and what governing bodies are being asked to do, or not do, by the government and its agencies. This should be the proper role of overarching bodies like the NGA, but clearly the task of holding the HSE and government to account on such technical matters is challenging. We know that asbestos consultancies and industry bodies hold deep reservations about the UK safety standards, but they too are beholden to the HSE, often for their license to practice. Understandably, most are reluctant to speak out, or as one confided, bite the hand that feeds. This leads to a worrying culture of complicit silence. A key objective of the Airtight on Asbestos campaign is to improve the UK's current air testing regime. This is used to monitor the level of airborne asbestos particles in buildings. Unlike some other countries, the UK has still not introduced a safe environmental exposure limit for inhabiting or working in buildings containing asbestos. The HSE assume that if asbestos is managed correctly, it will not become airborne and does not therefore require monitoring. But this is simply not plausible. We know that some environments, like schools, cannot be so easily controlled. As campaigners have consistently pointed out, asbestos concealed in ceilings, walls, and pipework could easily be disrupted by a desk or a chair knocking against it. Angela Eagle, MP for Wallasey, was the UK Environment Minister who had steered legislation for the ban on asbestos through Parliament in 1998. In a recent interview with LBC, she stated,
"If there is, as we think, asbestos present in 80% of schools, it's very important that it doesn't become airborne and that it isn't disturbed. And if it is disturbed, it's possible that by living and working in that environment over time, there may be a higher risk."
But we are not looking for or detecting these high levels of risk. Currently, air monitoring is not a legal requirement in the UK, except in the case of removal or remediation, where it is a mandatory part of the site clearance certification process. During this process, air is filtered through a pump and particles are collected for analysis using phased contrast microscopy, PCM. Airborne fibres are counted, and if the concentration of fibres is less than a legislated limit, then the site is declared safe to enter and a clearance certificate is issued. The UK measures asbestos up to a level of 0.01 fibres per cubic centimetre of air. This is the limit at which PCM can detect particles. Unfortunately, this method cannot detect small or thin asbestos fibres below this level, and which are known to be carcinogenic. The UK's approach to monitoring airborne fibres permits a clearance level in the event of remedial work, which is 5 times less sensitive than the environmental limit allowed in France, and 10 times less sensitive than the acceptable occupational exposure limit in Germany. Why is this? Part of the reason is that both France and Germany have superior standards and practices. Following a lengthy process of scientific evaluation, France introduced sweeping reform of its asbestos regulations. This included the introduction of a safe environmental limit, mandatory periodic air testing, and improved methods of analysis using transmission electron microscopy, TEM, which is 500 times more powerful than PCM used in the UK. Hugo Perez, a business development manager at ITGA, a French asbestos laboratory and consultancy, explains how TEM is so much more suited to detecting airborne threats from asbestos.
So I think we came to TEM in France based on the scientific evidence. We have a higher magnification with TEM, so it will enable us to detect thinner objects. And in the TEM, you have also the chemical identification. When you find the fibers, you can say if it's asbestos or another mineral fibers, because you will know the chemical identification. You cannot do that with PCM.
Unlike the HSC, the equivalent French and German authorities do not assume asbestos to be safe and less disturbed, but rather assume that all buildings containing asbestos pose an inherent risk of exposure and so should undergo high-quality, sensitive air monitoring. Consider for a moment the fact that the current mortality rate from asbestos-related diseases in France is 1,700 deaths per year, compared to 5,500 deaths in the UK. Why then, when the UK records more than twice the number of such deaths each year, does France take better precautions than HSE? This failure of HSE to function at par with its French and German counterparts is in breach of its legal duty under the UK's Health and Safety at Work Act of 1974, to promote, quote, the best practicable methods of health and safety to ensure the welfare of employees. We can only conclude that there is, in the UK, either a lack of awareness or lack of interest in the scientific evidence for other air monitoring and microscopy regimes. The problem is, in other words, cultural. Parliamentary accountability for the HSE is neither fixed nor especially firm. Oversight is with the Department for Work and Pensions, and the minister responsible has changed 6 times in the past 4 years. Mims Davies, the Parliamentary Under-Secretary of State for Employment, is currently responsible for the HSE. David Morris, the Conservative MP for Morecambe and Lonsdale, has lent his support to Airtight on Asbestos and has since written to Mims Davies on behalf of the campaign. In his letter, David Morris highlighted the worrying death rate among teachers and nurses and the need to improve air monitoring in line with international best practice. In her reply, the minister states that the current duty to manage asbestos, quote, never intended to include a periodic air testing requirement for normal occupation, and that, quote, statistical research does not support the view that former teachers and nurses are at any particular risk compared to the general population. We spoke to David Morris to get his reaction to the minister's response and to ask what he believes ought to be done next.
I would like to say to the minister that we should have at least a firm register of where this hazard is, because it's about protecting the public, and especially public service workers. If they're working in buildings that has asbestos, it only takes it to break and it to get into some ventilation system, and, you know, who knows what could happen. You know, I do think it's time that we did sort this out. I think once we do get back to a semblance of normality, the way forward is to request a meeting with the minister and sit down and have a formal meeting with the minister and say, look, we have a body of evidence here that suggests that new rules need to be legislated for. And, you know, we would like and welcome the minister's input in this. Given what's going on with trying to preserve lives, I think what's needed is certainly a change in the legislation, even if it's on a minor level, to acknowledge that there is a problem there that needs to be addressed, because, you know, the more we turn away from this issue, the more of a hazard it could be. So it's just a case of us sitting around the table to make it happen. I can't wait to get back into Parliament and to reconvene properly, so I can bring these issues up with the minister and in a more forceful way.
Stephen Timms, a Labour MP, is also chair of the Department for Work and Pensions Select Committee, and has also written to the minister on behalf of the campaign. He has not received a response and has told us that he did not expect a quick reply. However, he did share his reaction to the minister's letter in response to David Morris.
I'm disappointed by that and a bit surprised, really, because there is a requirement to use the best practical technique, as the legislation says. So for them to be kind of saying they don't need to bother with this does seem very puzzling. We know that there are asbestos fibres which are carcinogenic, which the technology we're using cannot detect, whereas in France they're using technology which can detect all those fibres. We clearly do need to be detecting them. We need to know where those fibres are in the air, because they can and do cause mesothelioma. So it's a very clear case, and it is a matter of life and death. The importance of making these improvements cannot be overstated.
Stephen Timms laid out his idea of what to do next.
If the minister continues to deny that change is needed, we'll have to do some further work. And it would certainly be possible for the Select Committee, for example, to open an inquiry on this subject, to take evidence, to issue a call for evidence to anyone who wants to submit it, to have evidence hearings, and then to put some of those materials to the minister in a public evidence session, and bring the evidence to bear on the minister in that way. And if that's what we have to do, then that's certainly an option. I think one of the problems the Health and Safety Executive has is the resources that it's had at its disposal have been quite significantly reduced over the last 10 years. At the moment, it's got an enormous workload because of responding to coronavirus. So it may be that its reluctance is just a question of managing the enormous pressure it's under at the moment. But I think the case is an open and shut case. I think there is no question that these changes need to be made. And I hope it's not going to take too much effort on the part of the campaign and others in Parliament to bring about the change of heart that we need.
The UK's health and safety regime starts with the presumption that the management of asbestos in buildings is safe, with only a remote risk of exposure. Other nations accept that asbestos is deteriorating and will release fibres. They have begun to address this problem with national asbestos plans, higher standards of asbestos air monitoring, mandatory periodic testing, and phased removal. Regulation of asbestos in the UK cannot ensure that employees or any other persons using buildings where asbestos is present are not exposed beyond a controlled level. Yet the UK remains blind to this best practice, and blind to what fibres it can see in the atmosphere. Charles Pickles, the man behind Airtight on Asbestos, told us about the changes he would ultimately like to see made to the HSE's guidance on asbestos management.
I would like for us to adopt into guidance the legislation with the Health and Safety at Work Act, which is to use the best available practical techniques for testing. The same also applies to the use of powerful databases in order to manage asbestos information. Information is power. We're well behind with our ability to manage and query asbestos data. Those really are the two biggest things. It's the testing regime and the need for powerful management of the data that we have.
You've been listening to the final episode of Dust to Dust, the four-part documentary series brought to you by Respublica on behalf of the Airtight on Asbestos campaign. We hope you found this series useful and informative. Please share the link with your contacts and partner organizations. To all listeners and contributors, thank you.